about your family, parents?
My father was Joseph Needleman, a merchant in Philadelphia. He was born in Philadelphia. He was one of five children. My mother, Sonia Chupak Needleman, was born in Russia and came to this country as a very young child. Settled in Philadelphia. I had one sibling, a brother, 3 years younger than I. I'm married to Roberta Pizer Needleman. We have two children, Joshua and Sarah. And I have a son by my first marriage, Samuel.
Would you tell us your date of birth and the ages of your children?
Yes. I was born on December 13th, 1927. But my son Samuel is about 40 years old. Joshua is 32. Sarah is 30.
And did you live in Philadelphia for most of your growing up years?
Yeah, I lived in Philadelphia, went to Overbrook High School, and then went to college at Muhlenberg College in Allentown. My family moved to Allentown, Pennsylvania. I went to Muhlenberg College and then returned to Philadelphia to go to medical school at the University of Pennsylvania. And then I interned at Philadelphia General Hospital. And then I was a research fellow at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And then went into the Army as a medical officer. 2 years. I was chief of pediatrics at Fort George Meade. Came back after my military service to finish my pediatric training at the Children's Hospital, which I did, and then became chief resident of pediatrics. And then I went into practice on the main line with Dr. Bill Rashkin. Bill developed a new procedure, a very important procedure in saving children from heart disease, and he became an instant professor, and I was left with practice. And then I entered psychiatry. I took a residency in psychiatry at Temple University for 3 years. And then I was head of consultation and education in the Temple University Mental Health Center. From there I went to Harvard Medical School and the Boston Children's Hospital, where I was associate professor of psychiatry until I came here to Pittsburgh in 1981.
What led you to this lead poisoning research?
Well, I treated lead poisoning as a pediatric resident.
Did you have a high incidence of it?
We had, at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, which is in the center city, we saw a number of cases. And the year I was chief resident, I enforced a rule that I had been taught, that is, that any child who had a stomach ache or anemia or behavior change would get a lead test. And I made my residents do that, and we just about doubled the admission rate. So it was quite clear to me that there was much more lead poisoning than was being diagnosed. And that intrigued me, and I thought that probably was a much more important problem than had been recognized. And then when I went into psychiatry as a child psychiatrist, I began to think about behavior disorders and learning problems in the inner city, and I just wondered how much of that was to do with it. So I returned to that subject in the late 60s to study it.
What is the percentage of lead that needs to be present to have an effect?
That's not clear. The more we study it, the less and less is needed. As we use better techniques and better design experiments, we find that effects at lowering overdoses. When I started off as a pediatrician, we were taught that a blood lead of 60 micrograms per 100 cc's was a toxic level. If the child had less than that, they were okay. It was very simple. You're either sick or you're healthy. But that didn't make sense because it's not like you throw a switch at 60.
Yeah.
And there were many children in Philadelphia and Baltimore and Chicago with blood leads of 40. So if 60 was toxic, it was hard to believe that 40 was safe. Now, the official definition of a toxic level is 10. So in that 25, 30 years, the level has dropped to 1/6 of what it was, and there's evidence that it's less than 10.
What about all of us that were growing up and didn't know anything about?
Well, chances are we all would have been better off if our lead levels were lower. Children today have much lower lead levels than you and I did. That's because we took lead out of the insulin. Primarily.
That was the chief source of lead?
That was one of the most important.
Was that in heating too, heating oil?
No, it's
not
in heating oil.
Okay, you're doing the
energy. You're doing fine.
Well, I figure if I understand it,
right.
Anyone else will too. So that has been your life's work, really.
Yeah, I got intrigued by it. And actually, I was in my office at the Temple Mental Health Center, which was in a brownstone house. It looked out on the school, public school, and I used to watch those kids every morning. My office was the living room, and I just wondered how many of those children, inner city children, were going to fail out of school because of the lead poisoning, never recognized. So I decided I would study it. Now, the way you diagnose it in the main is by a blood test, measuring the amount of lead in the child's blood. Peak exposure period for children is between about 13 and 30 months of age. That's when children get around and get into foreign substances and stuff like that. But the children in that school were 72, 80 months of age. And lead in the blood doesn't stay a long time. It gradually begins to wash out or go into other tissues, so that blood tests wouldn't be good in that population I was interested in. And I began to think about what else could be used to measure lead in the body of the child. Now, lead goes to bone. It's treated a lot like calcium, and it's put down in the bone. But you can't do bone biopsies. But there is a bone biopsy, and that's the baby tooth. So I developed a tooth assay. And see that button? That's what we used to give the children. And this is now 1971. I showed that children who were in the inner city had five times as much lead as children in the suburbs in their teeth, therefore in their body. And I showed that 20% of children in inner city Philadelphia had dentine lead levels in the range that children with poisoning did. We found some children who had recovered from poisoning who got their teeth. So we knew what the range was. And our estimate was that one child out of five in the inner city had the same amount. And from that, I was invited to come to Harvard to study it, to pursue this work, and see if we could demonstrate whether lead in the tooth was associated with lower performance, and that's what I did. I took some while to get the research funds. But after I did, I set up a team. We collected a large number of teeth from children in Somerville and Chelsea, Massachusetts. These were children who were soon to be normal, with not behavior disordered or lead poisoning. And we compared the lead levels in the upper and lower 10th percentile, highest and lowest. And we we did a lot of other things. We measured their family income, whether the parents were married or divorced, mother's intelligence, lots of things that could affect development. And after adjusting for those things, we showed quite persuasively that children with high lead teeth had lower IQ scores, had poor language function, had poor attention. And we also had a simple questionnaire that we gave to the teachers for every child in the school system. They asked 11 yes or no questions. Is this child distractible, yes or no? Organized, yes or no? Frustrated, daydreamer, things like that. Classroom performance. And, I'll get myself a glass of water. Can I bring anybody more?
No, it's not for me.
This happens when I start talking. Yes, we gave this
questionnaire
to over 2,000, to the teachers of 2,000 students, and it had 11 yes or no items, mostly around things like attention, the child learning in class. And we had a tooth lead on every one of the children. We divided them into six groups, the lowest to the highest, and then we just counted the proportion of bad grades from the teachers in each one, and we showed that as tooth lead levels went up, distractibility went up, frustratability, hyperactivity. On every one of the 11 items. And we published that plus IQ stuff in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1979. At that time, there was a good deal of ferment about whether low levels of lead did affect children. A lot of debate, and there were a few studies out, but this one answered that, responded to the questions that were being raised, and it was used to take lead out of gasoline. Lead began to be taken out of gasoline in 1975, but that was to protect the catalytic converter. The health was not on a health basis, but then it was removed completely because of health, and the work of my group was instrumental.
What are some of the other sources of lead?
Well, paint is the most important, old paint. Lead in the atmosphere is not important in this country anymore since we took down gasoline. In some places, it's in the water supply. Pipes have lead solder, and the water is soft. That is, it doesn't have a lot of minerals in it. It used to be in cans, but most of the cans for home consumption are aluminum now, don't have solder seams. It's in some home remedies, Hispanic home remedies. It's in some cosmetics, Hindu, Muslim cosmetics, which affects some children of that ethnicity. And in the soil, generally from atmospheric fallout or from weathered paint. That's the bulk of the sources for American children.
You say now it's down to the whole lead. What were you saying? It was 10%.
Well, no, we measure it in micrograms per 100 cc. That's millionths of a gram per about 3 ounces. And it used to be 60, it's now down to 10, but there's some evidence that it's even lower.
But there's no way to really eradicate lead totally if it's in the soil.
Well, the amount in the soil is not a great hazard. The hazard to American children is now old paint. Once we took it out of gasoline, the remaining threat is in old paint. There's still many houses that have leaded paint. It's most severe a threat in poor people's houses because their houses are deteriorated and the paint flakes and chalks, and the kids pick it up, get it on their hands, and put it in their mouth. That still is a problem. It's not nearly as bad as it was when I was in training, but it still is a problem. There may be 1.5 million children who are threatened by it in this country.
Can we go back a little bit?
Sure, any question.
Exposed to a religious upbringing?
Not very much.
No.
My father was not very religious. My mother's father, I remember going there on Friday nights for Shabbos. The family was all there, but in my own hometown.
No.
I was bar mitzvah.
And your children?
My middle son is very religious. He's a physician. He's very observant. My daughter is, she goes to synagogue, but she's not very religious. My eldest son is not very religious.
And now?
Yeah, we belong to Rosh Hashanah.
You do belong to. And you do observe some.
Mm-hmm.
When you were in school,
oh, yes. When I was growing up in junior high school, before that, primary school, through high school, I had a very close set of boys and some girls. I actually saw some of them about 1.5 years ago, after 50 years. Yeah. Well, I missed the high school reunion, but I had to be in Philadelphia to give a talk, and I went to a house of a dear old friend of mine, and a few of them came over. Had 50 years of very good friendship.
Did any of them achieve
fame? They were not people who went on to get a lot of education. They're fine people.
Did you ever keep in touch with any of your service connected?
No.
You were in the Army?
Yeah. My assistant at Fort Meade is a pediatrician, and I have seen each other on rare occasions. Six boys, and I was traveling to Springfield, Connecticut, yeah, when his wife was giving birth to their last child. I stopped in to see them, but I haven't seen them in my army friends.
Were you active politically or in any other cultural groups?
I was quite active in the anti-Vietnam effort. I was chairman of a group called the Committee of Responsibility, whose job was to take children who had been burned in Vietnam and bring them to this country for plastic surgery. I was the national chairman, brought 76 children to the U.S. for surgery, sent most of them back home and were finished. I visited Vietnam twice to make arrangements. And I guess my other major activity is public health policy around lead, trying to wipe the disease out, because it is a totally preventable problem.
Becoming close to Iraq.
Well, we had a kind of a high moment in 1991 when the Assistant Surgeon General James Mason declared that it was a totally preventable disease. I had persuaded him that was the case. And the federal government issued a policy statement called the Strategic Plan to Eliminate Childhood Lead Poisoning. And there was a great deal of momentum to do it. It's a terribly expensive proposition, but that payoff is huge in terms of money saved, special education, health. And so things have kind of slowed up since then because of opposition from real estate interests, defense attorneys, the lead industry, and for the time being, that idea that we can wipe the disease out has been abandoned. I really thought we had it in our grasp, and so did Jim Mason.
You grew up in Philadelphia proper?
Yeah.
Not in
suburbs? No, West Philadelphia, most of the time. Winfield, quite a time.
Do you remember anything in particular about the city that you loved, that you hated?
Well, I liked Philadelphia. I thought it was a splendid place. I was enamored of the University of Pennsylvania football team. I used to go to football games. I played football. And my grandfather, my mother's father, was a big pickle merchant in Philadelphia. She packs pickles. It was a very well-known firm, and I worked there on the truck for 1 year when I was real little. And I used to go down there Friday nights for dinner. My uncles, two of which are still alive, they were a big, happy group of people.
Did you have a lot of aunts, uncles, cousins that you grew up together?
No, my family's getting small. I have one aunt on my father's side who's still alive, and my mother's sister. My mother's still alive. My mother's 91. She's still alive. She's had some illness. Her sister, my beloved Aunt Doris, died a few years ago. So I was very close to her.
And their children?
Yes. They have, Doris had three daughters. I see every once in a while.
Doris is who?
Doris
is your mother.
My mother's sister. I played a little bit in high school. I played, street ball with my friends in the neighborhood. Played a lot of basketball and football.
Were you on any sports teams in school?
In high school in Washington, I was on the football team.
Did you receive any awards in high school or college?
I was elected to the Honor Society in college. And I was on the student council in college. And I was editor of the college newspaper.
Did anyone influence you in your choice of a career?
I don't think so. I was interested in science, and I was uninterested in business. All my family were in business, and I didn't want to do that. And I think I was about 10, I said, I want to be a doctor. And everybody patted me on the head, so I made the choice very early, and I don't think for any good reason, except some interest in science. My two sons are doctors.
Oh.
Very good doctors.
And they're in Philadelphia?
Well, one son is my younger one, he's my middle child, is a pediatric pulmonary fellow at St. Christopher's Hospital in Philadelphia. And my elder son is an oncologist in Norfolk, Virginia.
Does he have a daughter?
Yes, she's an attorney here in Washington, D.C.
Underachievers.
I have three very hardworking, very nice children. Very talented and very nice.
Do you think the doctor's sons became doctors because of you?
I think so. They both were, when I was chief resident at the Children's in Philadelphia, when my son Sam would visit me, he was only 10. I would take more rounds with him on Sundays in the hospital. And he was very interested in biology early as a young kid. Found anything dead, dissected. And I think my son Joshua, my younger son, was interested in what I did talking about.
Your daughter never expressed interest in being a
doctor? She said she was going to. Well, she actually took the pre-med course at Penn. But she discovered she didn't like the laboratory work. And so she very smartly withdrew. Changed her major, became an English major, and then when she finished school, she had been a columnist for the paper, very good writer, she decided that she wanted to leave the East, see some more of the country, so she went to Seattle, found a job as a legal assistant, actually initially a secretary and then a legal assistant researcher. And she decided she liked the law, and she turns out she has a real talent for it. She's first in the class in law school, and she's been very highly regarded.
She was out of school, went back to school?
Yes, she came back. She took 2 years in Seattle to look around, and then came back and went to law school in Washington.
Is that where she's practicing now?
She's with a law firm in Washington.
Washington, D.C.?
Yes. Right. Yeah, she went to Seattle and she came back to Washington.
Is she married?
Yes.
Are they all married?
My two younger children are married.
Younger children without children?
Not yet.
Did you ever feel any anti-Semitism in any part of your life?
Yes, not a great deal. I think I was fortunate. I lived in a Jewish neighborhood. Winfield was
Jewish
neighborhood. We had some difficulties with people across the bridge and over, but we got in a couple fights. They had fights a couple times. But in general, one didn't feel that. And then I went to a Lutheran college, and only twice in that college did I feel. Somebody wrote something on the blackboard when I was a freshman, and I stood up. I felt I had to say something, or else the next 4 years are going to be miserable. And so I asked that whoever wrote that meet me outside after class. I was 1944. The war was coming to an end, and I was 16. I graduated from high school when I was 16, and. There were some veterans on the campus who had come back to the GI Bill, and one of them was in that class and dwarfed us. I mean, he was been a combat pilot. And I was standing there waiting to see who was going to come up, and he walked over to me. But it turned out he said, I'll stand here with you. He was not Jewish, but he was offended by it. So it was a very nice moment. Homer Hoff was his name.
And did the person who wrote it come out?
Totally. So there were a couple of minor, but never anything terribly virulent. I've been fortunate in that regard.
Do we need to turn that
off? I guess we'd better.